Last week, the investigative newsroom ProPublica published a story that traced Utah's response to the coronavirus. Reporter Lisa Song explained how, in the early days of the virus, Governor Herbert was way ahead of the game.
At the beginning of the pandemic in March, the state of Utah was acting pretty decisively. The governor actually decided to close down schools in Utah a few days before New York City did.
Utah schools are dismissed for a period of 2 weeks in order to prevent, again, the spread of the
And so back at the end of March and beginning of April, Utah was under this voluntary stay-at-home order from the governor.
Stay safe, stay home.
We must continue to take actions as individuals to avoid unnecessary illness and death due to COVID-19 in Utah.
And many local policymakers,
folks waking up here in Summit County,
were also allowed to set their own local regulations.
County leaders making the decision to issue the stay-at-home order.
So for a while, Utah was doing a really good job at bringing down the peak and bringing down the number of cases. And then
called a Senate to order for the third special session of the 63rd legislature.
There came this shift related to politics. In April, the state legislature held a special session to pass a number of bills related to the pandemic.
These are times that I don't think I've ever experienced before in my lifetime as we face a pandemic and as we see the economic challenges that it presents.
And Senator Stuart Adams had talked about in the media.
Senator Stuart Adams, thanks for joining me today.
That it was time to focus more on the economy.
For me, it's number one priority. I mean, I call it sustainable social distancing.
That up until then, the state had really done everything it could to close down businesses and get the numbers down. And now he said, we need to move into this new phase of thinking more about reopening and how to get the economy going again.
Utahns have done a great job. You've seen us bend the curve. And it's time to talk about how we can move forward and get business back in business.
So during this special legislative session, the legislature created this new commission that would have 10 members. And this commission would play a really key role in deciding how the state would reopen, what those steps would look like, and when the transition would occur. Some of them are politicians, some of them are businessmen. One of them is the co-director of the state health department. But out of all 10 members, only two of them have medical or public health expertise. And one of the other things that this commission did was it took away power from local regulators so that cities and towns and counties now needed permission from the governor before setting any restrictions that were stricter than the rules he had in place.
Now, explain that. Why is it that there are so few public health officials on this commission that is making these important recommendations about, you know, when to phase in which restrictions, how to manage all of these case accounts, and how to, you know, basically deal with the public accounting for all of this? Why so few actual medical personnel?
I did speak to the one member on the commission, Dr. Michael Good, who is a physician, and he talked about how important it was to have multiple varying points of view on a commission like that. But it does seem like a rather large discrepancy to have only two people with public health or medical expertise on a panel of 10 members.
Song says through email correspondence and interviews, she found that concerns for the economy started to outweigh concerns about public health in Utah. And as a result of this shift, the number of cases started to climb.
Another unsettling record in the COVID-19 pandemic.
A doctor telling ABC 4 News that the average number of people currently hospitalized is concerning.
The White House task force sees Utah and the United States have not come close to controlling the situation.
The bottom line is if we don't turn these numbers around and soon, our healthcare systems say they'll be overrun with COVID-19 cases.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Utah's response to the coronavirus, and we're asking just who is making these decisions about public health right now. In her reporting for ProPublica, Lisa Song writes about how in March, Governor Herbert had to choose someone to coordinate the day-to-day operations of this outbreak. And he had various options, but he chose Jefferson Burton, former Adjutant General of the National Guard. Burton stepped down from the role this week. Today was his last day on the job, but for 4 months, this was the person in charge, a man who had limited disaster management experience and no medical background.
What had happened was back in March, the head of the state health department was Dr. Joseph Miner, and he's a longtime public health official with medical degrees and a degree in public health. And he himself has a lung condition that makes him extra susceptible to COVID-19. So at the end of March, the governor announced that he was appointing a new leader to take on the day-to-day responsibilities of the pandemic. And the person he appointed was Jefferson Burton, who's a former head of the Utah National Guard. And Burton has some experience in disaster management, but he doesn't have medical training and he doesn't have public health expertise. So all of a sudden, you have the point person in the state health department is someone who isn't trained in public health. And later, Burton is appointed as co-chair of this powerful commission. And what I found during my interviews was that Dr. Miner, who is still the co-director of the health department and obviously involved in a lot of what the department is doing, has actually never been to one of these commission meetings.
Yeah. Well, you also write that he wasn't present, even in a virtual way, for some of the key decisions that were being made by this commission. He didn't attend a meeting. And we should also say, and this is significant for people because Angela Dunn, the state epidemiologist, was such a face early on during all of this. You, in your reporting, you found that she wasn't also involved in those meetings, in the final decisions of how some of these restrictions were going to be loosened. Talk about that, if you would.
So when we started this story, we knew about this decision that the commission had made in late May. And that was when the commission decided to allow gatherings of up to 3,000 people indoors or 6,000 people outdoors. We had the emails of public health officials like Angela Dunn and some of the local health officers as well. And we could see in the emails that they were taken aback by this decision and they had concerns and some objections. So when I started talking to these public health officials, they all told me that they were not in the room when this decision was made, and they had no idea what science or data was being used to justify this very large change. And they kept telling me, you have to talk to the commission. The commission, they're the ones who made this suggestion. They're the ones who made this recommendation, and they're the ones who decided to do this.
Yeah.
And so it became obvious that neither Dr. Dunn nor Dr. Miner had been at these commission meetings. And the commission is the one that ultimately makes recommendations of what activities are allowed under each of the reopening phases. And then they give those recommendations to the governor, who then decides whether or not to follow those suggestions.
Why do you think Dr. Miner and Dr. Dunn, why were they left out? Was there some tension between the health department and the governor's office or other state officials? Was it an attempt at keeping health officials at arm's length in making these key decisions because they were worried about the effects on the economy? What conclusions can we make from that?
You know, I can't speak to the intent behind those specific decisions,
yeah.
But there's at least one representative of the health department who is not a part of the commission, who goes to the commission meetings. And that is Jefferson Burton's deputy, Richard Saunders. So it is possible for people who are not part of the commission to attend their meetings, at least on occasion. But despite that, neither Angela Dunn nor Joseph Miner have gone to the meetings. They do, however, get updated on the meeting's decisions after they occur.
And what do they say as a result of being briefed on all of that, and how much are they being listened to if they do respond? I mean, one of the things you do mention in the reporting is that, for example, when state officials were considering making a particular shift into, you know, from one tier to another, that Angela Dunn had sent this urgent memo to health officials in the state responding to it. The Salt Lake Tribune published it, as you say. So I guess the question is, what is their reaction to it, and how much attention is being paid if Angela Dunn, or for that matter, Joseph Miner, don't think it's the right thing to do?
It's obvious that there's a big difference between being told about decisions after they happen versus being in the room when these major decisions are made. And what we've seen again and again is public health officials making recommendations of what to do, but then having their advice ignored or pushed aside. We saw in that June 19th memo that Angela Dunn wrote, which the Tribune published, she was saying at the time, our case numbers are so high that if we don't get cases down to a certain number by a certain date, then we should shift the state back to orange, back to a more restrictive tier of reopening. And the governor, in response to that, said he was not going to do that, and he has not done that.
Yeah.
We have seen other examples where Dr. Dunn or other health officials have basically said, you know, I don't think we're ready for this next tier until such and such date. And the response, for the most part, is to move into that new tier before these public health officials think we're ready. So we have many examples where the state decided to reopen faster than what certain public health officials would like. And with this particular decision that started off our story of, you know, why would the commission suddenly want thousands of people to be able to gather together?
Yeah.
What we know is that around the time they made that decision, Angela Dunn and Joseph Miner and other health officials had a meeting of their own to discuss this. And they all had similar concerns. They were saying that we're not ready for this, that the science does not say it is safe to let 3,000 people gather indoors, even if they're all wearing masks. And despite their concerns, their objections were overruled. At the end of the day, the commission decided to go ahead with this change. So technically, right now, you are allowed to host these large events in the state of Utah with thousands of people together.
So, Lisa, if you're a state official, there are a few factors that could guide your decision to relax restrictions. I mean, you could use decreased cases. You know, you should say once the number of cases start going down, then we can start easing up a bit. Or you could look at how much your healthcare system could handle. And you say state officials chose the latter. Will you talk about that?
Yeah. So when you're thinking about the pandemic and reopening, there are a number of factors that health officials say you should look at. You should be looking at hospital capacity and availability of beds and ICU beds. You should be looking at the number of cases, the percent positive of cases, meaning of everyone who's tested, what percent of the results say that person has coronavirus. Mm. There are several other factors too, and you should be sort of balancing and looking at all of them together. But what has happened in Utah is this insistence and focus on one of the factors. And that factor is, what is the capacity of the healthcare system to handle this pandemic? So I was pretty surprised when, in a phone call, Dr. Miner told me that the state was now operating by letting cases go up as the state's ability to handle more COVID cases also increases.
Yeah.
So he basically said, as hospitals get better at treating coronavirus patients, as doctors gain more experience, as our ICU capacity goes up a bit, we are able to handle more cases. And so the members of the commission and other people with power to decide how the economy opens have decided to really use that metric of healthcare capacity as the main factor of how to reopen the economy and to actually allow cases to go up.
Yeah. So they're making, I want to make sure I get this right, they're making a conscious, calculated decision to stop slowing the spread of the virus in the interest of not causing too much damage to the economy?
So what Dr. Miner told me was that originally the plan was to move between the phases of reopening as cases went down, as the curve is flattened and there are fewer cases of the virus among the population in Utah. However, over time, instead of doing that, they decided we will now relax restrictions as our ability to cope with the virus goes up. And with that, they are allowing cases to go up a certain amount.
Yeah.
And this is not something that public health experts want. They're very worried about this strategy because you obviously want to keep cases as low as possible. It's not just about, can you find an ICU bed for someone who is sick with coronavirus? There are lots of health consequences to getting the virus, even if you survive and don't die.
So just to say a little bit more about this, so your reporting found that officials basically made this calculation about how many sick people the state's health system could bear. So explain what that means. What were the inputs, as far as you can tell, involved in the calculation? That is, how does the way public officials are dealing with the virus change when they plug into the equation the economy? I mean, before they're just thinking about, look, the thing that matters is public health. But then when you have lawmakers and other business leaders who are sort of lobbying for the interests of the economy to come into account, how does that change all of this?
One of the factors they're really valuing is hospital capacity and ICU capacity and also the mortality rate. It is true that Utah has one of the lowest mortality rates from coronavirus in the country. And one of the press releases from the commission, for example, is saying just looking at case numbers alone is not a great indicator of the virus. We should also be looking at things like hospital capacity and mortality rate. And that is all true. But what you end up with is the state leaders are deciding on how to open the economy based on what the healthcare system can handle. Mm-hmm. And that allows cases to go up over time to a certain amount. The trouble with that is it's hard to calculate exactly how much your system can handle. And since cases go up exponentially, you can easily be overrun. You can easily overshoot what capacity you've calculated for.
Lisa Song. She's a reporter at ProPublica. It's a nonprofit investigative newsroom. We have a link to a report about Utah's management of the coronavirus crisis on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. This is Radio West.
Station Insider is KUER's weekly email digest. We'll bring you the most important news stories of the week, information about online events and services during the coronavirus situation, and of course, sneak peeks of what's happening at the station. Check out our other regular dispatches too, including the Radio West newsletter. To sign up for these weekly updates, just go to KUER.org/newsletters.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're tracing Utah's response to the coronavirus. Investigative reporter Lisa Song of the newsroom ProPublica is joining us. She's taking us through this story that she published last week, where she found how public health officials have been pushed aside in the decision-making process, all in favor of political leaders and business interests. Now, I should mention, we reached out to a number of elected and appointed leaders in charge of managing the state's response to the pandemic. Governor Herbert's office told us his schedule would not permit him to join us. The same was true of Kristen Cox, executive director of the governor's Office of Management and Budget. We still haven't received a response from Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox. As for General Jefferson Burton, who until today was running the day-to-day operations of the coronavirus response, he declined to participate on the show. Lisa Song talked to a number of Utah officials who told her to keep Utahns healthy. They had to think of more than just the virus itself.
What I heard was that if you don't pay enough attention to the economy, then rising unemployment has its own public health consequences, whether mental health consequences or physical health. And that is certainly true. But the reverse is also true, that if you pay too much attention to the economy and not enough to public health, if people don't feel safe going out and they don't have confidence that they can participate in everyday activities outside, then that also has a negative impact on the economy. I don't think anyone is saying it's easy to find the right balance, but what you tend to hear from people on the commission is obviously is they'll say things like, we want to move the economy along and open as fast as possible in a safe way because a bad economy has bad consequences for public health. But it's important to remember the opposite is also true. And, you know, what public health and economists have been saying for a long time is that if you have a state where the economy is starting and stopping, where you reopen to a certain amount, but you reopen too quickly and have to scale back and you're starting and stopping, that has consequences for both your state's economy and public health.
What have you heard from the governor of Utah?
Yeah, I reached out to the governor's office several times. I left phone messages and sent emails. I was not able to get a comment or interview from them.
They did email you a statement you mentioned. Give us a sense of what that said. And what was the explanation, I guess, that you're getting from the governor's office?
Right. Well, the explanation I got was not from the governor's office, but from Jefferson Burton. In the course of reporting this, I requested phone interviews with every member of the commission. I was able to talk to Michael Good, but Jefferson Burton was not available for an interview. He sent me a statement that talked about that the commission and the state looks at a bunch of different factors, like hospital utilization, the growth rate of the virus, the number of tests being performed, and that there aren't any hard and fast rules of what data or what data points automatically trigger a move to the next phase, but that the commission is looking at all of these factors together and looking at how different geographic areas have different COVID situations. And then at the end, they make a recommendation to the governor.
But no response to the question that you asked about why it is there aren't more healthcare officials on that commission. Why so many political figures? Why so many business figures? Why so few healthcare actual experts?
Right. So in my emails to them, I sent them a lot of questions on criticism about the makeup of the committee, how many people felt that the commission was valuing economics more than public health, and they did not address those questions.
I'm not sure the significance here, but we should mention it, as you do in your article, that Jefferson Burton is running for office. He's running for the legislature. Is there something of a conflict that you discovered or reasons to raise some questions about conflicts of interest here or something?
I think there may be potential for conflict of interest because he was running for office at the same time that he was leading the state health department. And on the commission, three of the major donors to his campaign are also members of the commission, which he leads. But we did not get any responses specific to that.
Right. One of the things that you write about in the piece is how the easing of restrictions in the state, you know, recommendations made more by prioritizing the health of businesses anyway, that's part of the contention, that this somehow may have given a false impression that the risk was over, that like the coast was clear. Talk a little bit about that, this impression that has been left by the easing of these restrictions in the sort of rank and file in the state.
Yeah, there's a lot of concern that there's a communication gap, because as the state allows more businesses to open and more everyday activities to resume, it gives the impression that things are back to normal and your personal health is no longer at risk or at much less risk if you go out and participate in these activities. And that means that people are less likely to take social distancing seriously, less likely to wear masks. And this is something that Dr. Angela Dunn and other public health officials really wrestled with in some of their emails to each other. You can see them trying to think, how can we improve the messaging so that people in the public take more responsibility for their own safety, so that people are still trying to protect themselves even as the business restrictions are lifted. And the confusion over this is partly because the different reopening phases in Utah sound like they have to do with your health risk. The phases are named things like moderate risk versus low risk versus the new normal. So intuitively, people hear those phrases and think, if we're now in the low risk phase, which much of Utah is, then people think that means there is a low risk of me catching the virus if I go out and participate in the economy. But the truth is, as restrictions lift, the risk of you personally catching COVID actually goes up. So you as an individual should take even more care to wear masks and distance yourself from others.
So I guess there's this question that comes up. If the commission is easing restrictions in the interest of trying to get the economy going again, they're putting some weight on that factor, then it seems like it worked. You write about the fact that the economy has bounced back. Unemployment claims are dropping now. The unemployment rate is really under half of the national average. So you could, I guess, make the argument, if you're on the commission, that this is working. The economy is bouncing back. But what are others saying about that particular thing? Because obviously what you get at in the piece is, well, that recovery could just be temporary. And experts told you if the infections rise, this recovery is just going to stall out again.
Yeah. So one of the concerns is if Utah is overwhelmed with the number of cases, if its hospital system ends up being overwhelmed, or the cases rise so quickly that the governor does decide to ratchet things back, then this starting and stopping of the economy is really detrimental and will wipe out at least some of the gains that have been made so far. The other factor is that public health officials say it's important for residents to trust their leaders, to trust their political leaders and their public health leaders. And if there is this discrepancy between what the economic reopening phase is versus the reality in cases going up, then that erodes public trust in government and health institutions. And that's not a good thing. At one point, even the governor said in a press conference that perhaps the way the state labeled the different phases of reopening was a mistake because it was misleading and helped people believe that they were no longer at risk if they went outside. And so one of the things that's happening in Utah is there's this rising pressure to have a statewide mask mandate. We know that masks are one of the simplest things you can do to get overall COVID cases down. But this is also something that's very politicized and very controversial in Utah. So far, the governor has resisted requiring masks in public spaces, but there are some cities and counties that do have a mask mandate.
I guess the hypothesis that you were working with is whether or not concerns for the economy in Utah outweighed concerns for health. And you said it's hard for you to measure intent in all of this, but you think what you found supports that case?
I think what I found was that, yes, again and again, the commission acted in a way to relax business restrictions and take steps to reopen the economy in ways that went against what public health officials were recommending. they were acting more aggressively or more quickly than what health experts said should happen. And the timing for that matches up, that as the state eased restrictions, the cases really started climbing in a really alarming way.
Yeah. Well, as to that point, the infections are rising. They began to surge, as you say, late May. So I guess the question is, where are we now? And do you have any sense that the governor is starting to rethink maybe where they— I mean, I know that, for example, nationally, President Trump has sort of moderated his tone about all of these things. And I'm wondering if you're finding the same kind of thing from the governor. What are you hearing about that as far as you can tell?
I think it's clear the governor is seriously considering this. He did say in a news conference that he wanted Utah to get the average cases down to below 500 cases a day by August 1st, and that if Utah doesn't meet that goal, then he would reconsider restrictions. Perhaps that refers to putting in a statewide mask mandate or ratcheting back certain businesses. It's a little bit unclear. But I think the beginning of August may be a time when we'll see some news out of the governor's office. And last I checked earlier today, the average daily cases have gone down quite a bit. They're now at something like 540 cases a day. So not quite 500, but not too far off. But that is because over the past few days, there's been relatively few tests being done. So the number of tests being done every day goes up and down depending on what part of the week it is. There tends to be fewer tests performed on weekends and towards the end of the week. So I think in a few more days, we'll get a better idea of what the longer-term trend is in Utah.
Lisa Song, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Lisa Song, she's a reporter at ProPublica, a nonprofit investigative newsroom, and we have a link to her report on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. This is Radio West.
Using your smart speaker, starting your day with NPR Utah has never been easier. All you have to do is tell it to play KUER, and we'll be there throughout your morning with news and the latest Utah stories.
Now, the state of Utah has made an important move in this controversial issue. It's the first state in the country to protect—
That's KUER on your smart speaker. Just tell it to play KUER.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been talking about that balance officials are trying to find in the response to the coronavirus between keeping cases down while allowing the economy to get back on track. The investigative newsroom ProPublica published a story last week that raised questions about whether the state had tipped that balance in favor of business and that public health officials are being left out of critical decisions in the response. And ProPublica is not the only news organization scrutinizing all of this. The Salt Lake Tribune has also been asking just who is driving these decisions. Tribune reporter Bethany Rogers has been writing about a group of consultants, business consultants, that have been playing an important role in all of this. It's a group called Gold Rat Consulting.
Gold Rat Consulting is a group of business management consultants that specializes in something called the theory of constraints. It's a theory that was created by a physicist named Eli Goldratt, Dr. Eli Goldratt. And this group of consultants has had a pretty long relationship with one of Governor Herbert's top cabinet members, Kristen Cox, who's in charge of the governor's Office of Management and Budget. They've been involved in everything from prison construction, wine and liquor, the state stocks in its liquor stores, helping create efficiencies throughout state government, and basically just providing consultation for Chris Cox as she tries to manage the state's workforce.
Tell us who hired them and why it is that they were hired, as far as you can tell.
They were hired by Kristen Cox, again, to provide consultation services during the pandemic. They were hired through a pre-existing state contract that allows pretty much all state agencies. It's called a cooperative contract, and it allows government agencies to hire Goldratt and use its consulting services without having to go through the full procurement process. So it's kind of like a blanket contract that people can piggyback onto if they want to use Goldratt's consulting services. So there was no new procurement process when the state hired Goldratt or asked Goldratt to provide consulting with in relation to the pandemic. They just kind of asked them to come back and expand on a contract that they've had for some time with the state. And in fact, they were already providing constant consultation help to the Office of Management and Budget, because the Office of Management and Budget before the pandemic even hit had been somewhat short-staffed. So it was kind of just an expansion of that agreement and arrangement.
Say a little bit more about the relationship between Kristen Cox, the executive director of the governor's Office of Management Budget, and Goldratt. I mean, as I understand it from your reporting, she hasn't worked for them necessarily, just with them over the years?
Yeah, they've developed a pretty tight partnership, it seems, over the years. She is definitely a proponent of this theory of constraints that Goldratt specializes in, which kind of emerged. The idea behind it was that in an assembly line in a factory, for instance, there's one link in the chain that's going to slow you down. So you should invest all of your resources in correcting that one link in the chain in order to maximize efficiency throughout the system. And so that theory has been applied in a lot of different business settings, but Kristen Cox has kind of gained national recognition as being one of the first people to try to apply that same ideology to a government setting and to kind of pioneer it here in Utah in government agencies. So as she's done this, you know, she's used several different consulting groups that specialize in this theory, but she's really gravitated towards this Goldratt group over the years and has forged a pretty tight-knit relationship, it seems, with a lot of their leadership. She's even co-authored a book with one of the executives at Goldratt. The Office of Management and Budget holds an annual conference on good management practices, and you know, it has hundreds of state employees, and it's open to others as well. So it's a large conference, and it's organized jointly by both Goldratt and the Office of Management and Budget. And she's spoken at Theory of Constraints conferences across the world, and she just seems basically to have established pretty close relationships with this particular company.
And you say along the way she's funneled millions of dollars of state taxpayer money to Goldratt.
Yeah, that's across state government, but I think the Office of Management and Budget was definitely the entity that had the strongest ties with Goldratt and has used them and drawn on their services most heavily.
I wanted to ask you a little bit more about the way all of this is being considered and calculated, because you mentioned that management paradigm, the theory of constraints. Mm-hmm. As you understand it, how is that theory now being applied to the state's response to a pandemic, to a disease? How are they saying the theory of constraints applies here?
So it's not entirely clear exactly how the theory is fully being applied to Utah's coronavirus response. I've gotten some mixed messages depending on who I've talked to. So the Office of Management and Budget has said that Goldratt, which is, you know, they specialize in management and business consulting, that they haven't really been involved in any public health decisions, and that they have been focused on helping the state gather expertise and have helped with their data analysis and helped with efficiencies. Mm. However, I've gotten kind of a different sense when I've talked to some other people. I spoke with the head of the state's public health lab, who said that Goldratt was pretty instrumental in rolling out an economic model that was the basis for establishing some testing targets, the target of doing 7,000 tests a day. And this model apparently was developed to try to guide the state in getting business and the economy back open again as soon as possible and try to figure out what exactly the state needs to do in order to get there. And they concluded that they would have to test at these certain levels in order to get there.
So what, now, what does all of this tell you about that question, that really important question of whether state officials are putting more weight on the health of the economy and business as opposed to keeping coronavirus cases down? Because that is what your reporting is getting at, and that's what the ProPublica piece is getting at, is that question, whether or not the state at some point experienced some shift and decided, as opposed to listening to public health officials, listening to business consultants and business leaders. So what are you understanding about all of that based on your reporting?
The statement that the Office of Management and Budget gave me in response to this story was really, people are hurting on the economic front, and you know there are obviously serious public health considerations at hand, and both of those are being taken into consideration by the Office of Management and Budget. However, I mean, in talking to Dr. Atkinson-Dunn, the head of the State Public Health Lab, she said that the economic model that Goldratt developed was named that because it was focused on the economy. It wasn't necessarily coming from a perspective of case reduction. It was coming from a perspective focused on how do we get Utah's economy running again.
So representatives of Goldratt told you that their work is just data crunching, that they're not really providing this guidance on healthcare or policy. But say something, if you would, about this paper that they helped write back in March, because you said it reveals that this isn't just data crunching, that they're making recommendations, actual recommendations about public health policy there.
Yeah, this was a paper that the Goldratt consultant, who is working closely now with Utah on coronavirus response, he wrote it and co-authored it back in mid-March. And it's really sweeping recommendations for stopping COVID-19, not just in Utah, but pretty much across the world. And it has specific health policy recommendations. The recommendations are, we should isolate people in communities of about 1 million people each and heavily restrict travel between each of these zones. And interestingly, it also talks about the importance of a contact tracing app that in the paper sounds a lot like what Utah tried to do with its contact tracing app. So there's definitely some echoing there.
Is there some legitimate question here of self-dealing, or at least of a conflict of interest on the part of the governor's Office of Management and Budget, do you think?
Kristen Cox doesn't have any direct financial interest in Goldratt. She has co-authored the book, as I mentioned before, with a Goldratt executive. She directs all of the proceeds of the book to charity, so she says she does not benefit financially from that. The relationship with Goldratt has raised questions, though, because Kristen Cox has been kind of cultivating an image as an expert in this theory and even a pioneer in the area of applying it to government. And she also has her own government consulting company on the side. So there have been some concerns about whether, you know, her relationship with Goldratt and her getting attention as sort of a practitioner of this theory is somehow benefiting her personally, financially. But she says that her consulting work is, you know, pretty spotty, that she only does it once in a while. It's nothing major, and that it doesn't conflict in any way with her work in government. That's what she told me last year when she spoke with me about her relationship with Goldratt and her consulting work that she does on the side.
How much is the state paying for Goldratt? And maybe, I don't know if you can tease out just the coronavirus bit. How much is the state paying for that consulting?
They have I believe $600,000 contract with Goldratt right now. They've only paid out a portion of that, but they...
Didn't Goldratt say they were giving the state a deal, like a discount or something?
Yes. It was supposedly a discount on the rate that they were charging the state before the pandemic.
So overall, you said 600,000, as far as you can tell? Yeah. But I guess the question is, why do you need a consulting firm? If you have public health officials to help you make decisions about what restrictions they should be employing throughout the state and things like that. Why do you need a consultant group? I mean, what are they supposed to be providing that's different, according to state officials, or valuable? What are they saying? Like, what's this value that they're adding that a public health official or a group of public health officials or infectious disease experts wouldn't be able to provide?
The Office of Management and Budget has said that they have been shorthanded and that they have needed the extra help, just not in necessarily looking at health policy and what to do from an epidemiological standpoint, but just from a day-to-day operational standpoint. Mm-hmm. They've needed help looking at the data and trying to make sense out of it and, you know, guidance in how to manage state employees amid a pandemic and try to smooth out workflow. According to them, that's really the benefit that GoldRat provides. I did speak with someone who is a former epidemiologist at the Department of Health who told me that there is room for that kind of expertise, that pandemics are complicated and there are a lot of different factors in play. And having someone who has a different perspective, who maybe comes from a different vantage point, is not a bad thing. It's just when people who don't have public health expertise start to make public health decisions or cross those lines where it can become a problem.
And we also should mention, as you do in your reporting, that the state, that it's not just GoldRat. There are others that the state has employed in terms of consulting firms. You mentioned the other one, Levitt Partners, at least another one, Levitt Partners. This is a firm that's run by former Governor Mike Levitt.
Yeah, that's correct. So not the only consultants that the state has used. I will say that Levitt Consultants is a little bit different in that they specialize in healthcare intelligence. And the former Governor Levitt he was Health and Human Services Secretary for President George W. Bush. So he has some more, it seems, direct experience in this area than GoldRat seems to.
Right. I mean, but that's the difference, right? I mean, and in fact, isn't this what GoldRat told you? They said, look, we're not handling the healthcare decision stuff. We're leaving that up to Levitt Partners and others. Your reporting found that maybe that's not exactly accurate, but that's what Levitt Partners is about, right? They are supposed to be consulting agencies about public health issues.
Yeah, exactly. So that's really the question, is where is GoldRat providing guidance? Are they sticking to, you know, the management principles and the data analysis, as the Office of Management and Budget says, or are they providing guidance in policy decisions, like was laid out in the paper written by one of its top consultants, and, you know, developing economic models, which they apparently developed in concert or, you know, with expertise and input from the health department. But, you know, the fact that they were helping develop, you know, a model that has been used to make decisions about the state's coronavirus response says something about how many areas they've been involved in. I'll also add public records and emails that we were able to get through information requests show that GoldRat's consultants were definitely involved in discussions around some of the state's largest initiatives so far, including Test Utah and the Healthy Together app. So, you know, how great of a role they had in directing and guiding these conversations isn't entirely clear, but they were in the mix, the emails show. Hmm.
So, Bethany, what's a fair assessment of the, I guess, the consequences of what seems to be a shift away? At least the ProPublica piece mentions this. Your reporting sort of indicates that a shift away from early on in this process, public health officials driving all of this, to economic interests maybe driving this. Because you mentioned just 12 days after the governor loosened coronavirus restrictions and moved most of the state to yellow status, that a surge takes hold. So what are you understanding right now about the consequences of the way the state is been doing this lately?
So the state has been dealing with a surge in cases, and we've even reported about the memo Dr. Angela Dunn, the state epidemiologist, released raising concern about this surge and saying we might have to go back to a full shutdown if we can't get our case numbers under control. Our hospitals are filling up and we can't keep up with contact tracing. So it seems that the loosening of restrictions is definitely tied to this increase in cases. I will say that in the past few days, we've seen a decline in new case numbers, new daily case numbers from the, 800 a day new case numbers that we were seeing last week. It's not clear if that's possibly due to a decrease in testing or exactly why we're seeing those numbers drop a little bit in the past few days.
There's this kind of tidy summation of the problem expressed by Representative Jennifer Daley Provost in the article. And she told you that the state needs to stop thinking, and I'll just quote it as you do in the piece, the state needs to stop thinking that we can solve a public health crisis with a business plan and new technology. Do you think that sort of sums up the big question here in the piece?
Yeah, definitely. That's absolutely the concern that some of the lawmakers I spoke with have, is that we're bringing in business consultants to try to help us get through a public health crisis, and we're not listening to the right people. That, an app, maybe it has a role, maybe it could be helpful, but these sort of shiny business tools and ideas aren't what we need to be focusing on. We need to be listening to the people who have the background in public health as we're dealing with this crisis.
Bethany Rogers, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bethany Rogers, she's a reporter at the Salt Lake Tribune. She covers state government. We have a link to her stories on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. As always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.